Crawford Street. Notebooks and newsbeats, hear that piano rail. Take down the facts, Ace, write up the tale. Deadlines and dreamers, someday we'll meet, if only they turn left on Bird Street. Don't be a fool, Ace, trust nothing they say. Follow the money, make them all pay. Under a headline, over a beer, truth plainly told is what they most fear. Deadlines and dreamers, someday we'll meet down at the dark end of Bird Street. Well, good morning. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street, and we broadcast from 107.1 FM in Oroville, California. My name is Dan Gowerty, along with my colleague
Tom Nato.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us very much. Thanks very much for joining us. Glad to be here with you. And before we get started, I want to put a thank you out to Kathy and Dan Popa for filling in for me 2 weeks ago when I was on an English holiday. They did a commendable job, as always. And it was, yeah, a lot of fun, too, didn't you, Tom?
Oh, yeah. And we even got it all recorded.
Yeah.
Dan really contributed, as did Kathy. Kathy's talks on here from time to time, and we know that she's a high-quality performer. Dan was terrific.
Right, and Kathy also has a program on Wednesday evenings at 7 o'clock called By the People, For the People. So if you get a chance, tune into that. It's a great program. And she's also on... I guess she's not on Saturday morning. That's Marianne and Lulu who have their program at Saturday mornings that I called in. So, here we are. To let you know, we have a guest in our second hour at 9 o'clock this morning. And Tom, why don't you tell our listeners who our guest is going to be this morning?
Dr. Robert Yelanowitz.
Yes, indeed. He's a frequent contributor to this show, actually.
Who's not only an authority on ecological matters... but also, and environmental matters for that. There's a difference.
There is.
But also, he's well versed in Catholicism. And we're going to be talking to him about the Pope and what we're going to do about it.
Right. Yeah. Tom and I have a Catholic upbringing, but we probably aren't as.
Mine was dragging up. I was drug up.
Drug up. I get drugged to church every few weeks myself, and I usually leave halfway during the service and go look at the bulletin board, but we'll get into that later. Also, we'd like to remind our listeners to take a look at our blog on the internet. It can be located at www.ltobs.blogspot.com, or you can just Google us and type in Left Turn on Bird Street, and we come up at the top of the queue. So, now that we got all the thank yous out of the way, oh, one more thank you. Who do we need to thank? We just talked about it when we were going on the air. Come on, Bueller, anyone. We need to thank the composer of the Left Turn on Bird Street theme, Michael DeVera. We haven't given him credit recently, so thank you, Michael, for composing that. And the words, of course, were by...
Tom Nato.
So,
and they were spoken by... Dan Gowerty.
So is it?
It's a team effort.
Yeah, I like to think I was sounding
it's
like...
sort of a trinity, you know?
Right.
You know, like the Holy Trinity, sort of.
Father, Son, Holy... Who's who there, though, you know? I don't know.
I'm the Holy Ghost.
Anyhow, you know, before we get started on our regular program, we're going to talk about, out of the gate, we'll talk about the Pope. But as I had mentioned, I was over in England a few weeks ago on vacation. I just want to take a few minutes and just give you some... observations. We stayed with some friends of my wife, actually, a co-worker of hers from several years ago that she's kept in contact with through the years, David and Peter Gainsbury, in Runcorn, England, which is located about halfway between Manchester and Liverpool. Very gracious. Showed us all over northwest England. It took us to places we never would have gone on our own, for most definitely. But, you know, in the course of our visit there, our host, I couldn't quite gather what his political leanings were. In the bedroom, the guest room that we stayed, there were quite a few books up there about, of course, Winston Churchill and English history, and quite a few books on Margaret Thatcher. And during the course of our week's visit, I kind of got an inclination that he was probably a fairly moderate person, not very real conservative, not real liberal, kind of a middle-of-the-road sort of guy. But lo and behold, on the last night we were there, after we went out to the pub, of course we had to go to the pub, we were in England, right? Right? So we had a few beers, and we cracked open the Crown Royal that I brought over.
The one was shaped like a crown.
Yeah. You know, I thought he would appreciate it. Yeah, he really liked it, so that was a good choice.
He had it before, I'm sure.
No, he never had. He said he was not much of a whiskey drinker, and
but he is now.
He is now. He really liked it. It is good stuff. So that loosened the lips, as it were. Lo and behold, started talking first about Margaret Thatcher. Hated her. Could not stand her. In fact, I think he hated that era of England so much. That's why they lived in Brunei for about 18 years. I think during all of the Thatcher years, they lived in Brunei. They returned in the last several years.
Brunei is an island at an undisclosed location somewhere in the Pacific.
Yes, it's I guess geographically it's just southwest of Singapore.
Right. It's one of the few countries, or the only country left on Earth, that has a king with entire powers. There's no such thing as democracy.
Right.
They're only subjects.
So that's how much he disliked Margaret Thatcher. Of course, the subject veered off to George Bush, and he was telling us that he happened to be in...
sure that wasn't beard off?
Whiskied off is more like it, I guess. He happened to be in Amsterdam on the election night last November, and he was commenting with several of his business colleagues and whatnot that he said, and his business colleague said, who was Dutch, said, how can these Americans be so stupid to elect a man that can't even construct a coherent sentence? And you know what? I didn't have an answer for him. We tried to explain it to him, but there's no explaining it. But, you know, that was kind of the view. I don't think they necessarily dislike, you know, the limited view I had, you know, in England. They don't dislike Americans on a personal level. In fact, I found most everybody I encountered, even in London, a big city, to be pretty, you know, pretty friendly.
You mean they were able to make a distinction such as that?
Yeah, they can. They have the ability, the ability to critically think.
They can tell the left hand from the right hand.
Right.
They can tell. Opposed to how it's all got to be one big
lump together.
You're on that side, period.
Right. But they made the distinction, you know, they can make the distinction between somebody who is an American and the policies of the American government. And, you know, so I, yeah, I'm thank goodness for that.
Otherwise, we couldn't travel anywhere in the world.
That's right. But, you know, their view of Bush over there is that, you know, not only how bad a leader he is, but, you know, how can Americans be so stupid to elect him president, not one. Well, he wasn't elected the first time, but to re-elect the guy or re-select him the second time.
He wasn't elected either time.
Right.
Those were rigged votes.
But, so that was the view over there, you know, that Americans, they still like Americans, you know, on an individual basis, but they cannot understand Americans. And you know what? And the sad part of it was I really couldn't explain why we have Bush as a president. That's sad.
They couldn't understand, and you couldn't explain. There's something wrong there. It tells you that there's something wrong here.
Right. But, you know, we do try to explain why people vote for Bush on this. In fact, we're going to talk about this maybe in the
well, they're told to.
Yeah, right.
The pastor tells
them right.
to do it.
Well, we're going to get to that in the second half hour of today's program. But before we get that, and before we have Dr. Yulanowicz with us on at the 9 o'clock hour,
Bob.
Well, we have to add a certain amount of cachet to our program here.
You get his credentials right out there in front.
Well, that's right. We'll go, okay. But we want to, you know, refer to him as Dr. Yulanowicz. He worked very hard for that PhD, so we want to...
Sort of like Dr. Phil? he's smarter than Dr. Phil.
Yeah, well, he's a lot smarter than Dr. Phil, although I think Dr. Phil probably has a bigger audience than Bob does.
Dr. Phil is richer.
Yeah, certainly he's a lot richer. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about, of course, what else, Tom? Come on, anybody? NATO?
We're going to talk a little bit about the Pope.
Right. We want to talk about the Pope. We want to talk a little bit about his legacy. And we're going to we're actually going to try to handicap who will be the next Pope. So.
Oh yeah, and we've got some handicappers here, including Tom Cooper, an attorney who has cast his lot to run for Pope.
Well, yeah, why don't we talk about him first?
I was thinking about doing that, too.
Let's do Tom Cooper first, because let's get a little humor here going, first thing.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, there's a long list of people that I've run off. And of course, part of the first names didn't run off, but among the people that are said to be candidates are Patrick O'Malley, the Archbishop of Boston, and I think, get him over here, Rudy Giuliani.
Rudy Giuliani. And, he's a candidate for everything these days.
Right, and Bergoglio from Argentina,
mm-hmm.
and there's Hummus. He's a regular one, but there's, Tom Ridge, who's the head of Homeland Security, his name is on this list, too.
But anyway, he's on the short list.
But I just pulled out this to give you an idea of the quality of people who are running for Pope.
Running. It is a candidacy, though.
This is a resume that Thomas Cooper, attorney, running on the slogan, Tom for Pope.
I like that. Pope Tom.
Pope Tom.
Yeah.
Pope Tom. I guess it'd be Pope Tom Dan if you got to go this John Paul thing.
Right.
As I recall, Tom for Pope, Thomas Cooper, attorney, writes, my religious training tells me that the Pope is not required to be a cardinal or a bishop or even a priest. Any baptized Catholic male qualifies.
I'm qualified.
Me too.
Okay.
Well, wait a minute. I think mine was renunciated. Anyway, or it was withdrawn.
Thank God they don't have the Inquisition.
By popular
Tom.
Demand, yeah.
You'd be out of here. Yeah, who knows? Maybe they will.
So I have crossed that threshold, says Tom for Pope. I think that I have a lot of good ideas for the Catholic Roman Church, and hereby volunteer for the job. Unfortunately, I do not know any cardinals who are the only guys who get the vote. This is not a bad thing, because I think I have a better chance of getting elected if they do not know me. Here are some of the things that I have to offer if I could get elected. If you agree with this, please urge your cardinal to vote for me.
Me.
And he goes on a little list of things, but he's got a dozen or so. And parts of his platform. He begins by saying that I will not pretend that I talk to God or God talks to me. This kind of nonsense distracts people from figuring out what is right and wrong and allows people to abdicate their personal responsibility for decisions. He says he will also, we will be selling the unnecessary wealth under my control and establishing a foundation for development of underdeveloped countries.
I like that. That's good. That's reasonable. That's smart.
And as far as the Bible, the clergy comes, he says, we are dropping the requirements that ministers in Catholicism be single men.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Ordained ministers in our church in the future may be men or women, gay or straight. Unlike today, they must be virtuous men and women who have no history of molesting children. The current child molesters will be required to resign. As for the Bible, he says, let us stop pretending that this is the Word of God. It is a collection of stories written a long time ago that are quaint mythology. Use it accordingly. Goes into decentralization. Parishes are the main organization of the church. Ownership and control of parishes will be transferred to appropriate legal entities controlled by the parish members. Parishes will normally be expected to be self-sufficient. Parishes will hire their own ministers. Anyway, so it goes on. But one of my favorites here is, he talks about sex. I don't know if we can get into that.
We got to watch those seven words, I think.
Okay. Sex, he says.
Okay.
We're going to lighten up. Contraception will be taught. People will be urged to take control of their procreation. Have children when they choose to. Forget the sin thing. We are going to have to do some work to develop a healthy modern view on sex. Then he goes on to the subject of sex. This is my very favorite. Sin, hell, and purgatory. Hell and purgatory are out.
Oh, good, good.
They were a crude means of control for a long time, but basically a myth and unhealthy for use as a motivator. Guilt is overrated as a motivator. I know I had too much of it. Sin, we will all strive to find out what is right and wrong and strive to do it. Failing to do so is not sin, but we will find ways to help each other do the right thing and strive to do the right thing ourselves, which leads me to believe that this is a lefty liberal candidate for Pope. His chances are nil.
No. Well, that's true. Well, that brings us to the next topic. And where is Mr. Cooper based? Does it say?
No, it does say we're here, but there are some things that he, first steps he plans to take, and I found these are administrative things.
Yes.
As far as the headquarters, he says the Vatican is nice. Once we get rid of the opulence, one can live a simple life there, but we will consider moving somewhere out closer to the poor. Maybe
that's
Brazil,
good.
Maybe.
Yeah, perhaps.
The first nun. My wife, who is Jewish, is coming with me. We have been discussing what title she should get, perhaps first nun. Just kidding. She is not a nun, but she is a big supporter of the goals I set forth above. See? Apple computers. I really like Apple computers and will encourage people to use them, but that is strictly voluntary. P.S. We do own some share of Apple stock, so I have an obvious conflict of interest here. And finally, he says, no more funny hats and weird clothes. Just regular clothes, appropriate for the occasion. See other candidates for further details.
That's good. I like it. You know, so I think we should call up our local clergy and get a Tom for Pope, Tom Cooper, wherever you are, Tom Cooper.
I just want Pope. Tom for Pope.
Tom for Pope.
Put that on my bumper.
Well, people might think you're running yourself, Tom.
Well, I was considering it.
Were you? You were considering
but
running
I
it?
I knew that I wouldn't have. They have, since I went to Catholic schools, they have my record.
Oh, geez, Tom. Oh, forget about that.
This guy is a complete non-entity.
I like that. Well, moving on to more serious matters here regarding the papacy. You know, actually, we have some leading candidates. You know, according to some reports, there's no clear front runner for Pope. And this, you got to remember,
they're just claiming that.
You got to remember, this is it's a big deal because Pope John Paul II served for 26 years, third longest serving Pope in history. The Pope before him was in there for only, 1 month? That was kind of a weird set of circumstances. Excuse me. But, there are some some handicaps going on for the next Pope. And why don't you give us some of the leading candidates, Tom?
According to the LA Times, the potential papal candidates are 9 in number.
9.
And
isn't there some significance with 9 to
9? Number 9. I think
that's the Beatles song. Okay.
But I don't think John is Paul is. Well, it'd be another Paul. John Paul.
Yeah.
Anyway, they list at the top. I think they're doing this alphabetically to avoid any kind of. Francis Arinze, who is 72 years old. He's from Nigeria. Giovanni Battista Re. He's the prefect of the Vatican Department, overseeing the appointment of bishops. Oh, boy. I appointed you. You vote for me.
Yeah. Where is he?
It doesn't say on this.
Where he's from, rather.
No, but over in this other list, I have him as being from. I believe he's from a South American country called. No, he's from Italy.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that sounds like Italian.
He's the sort of assistant cop of the copy. Anyway, the one that I'm coming along, we got somebody named Gottfried Daniels, who was from Germany. Then Claudia Humes, who's from
Sao Paulo.
That's Brazil,
right?
And, he's considered a front runner by some. This is the guy that I think is either going to be Pope or make the Pope. It's Joseph Ratzinger. He's the enforcer of church doctrine at the Vatican. Likely to serve in a kingmaker role, but conservatives could seek to elect him as a caretaker pope. He's 77 years old.
78, actually, what I have. He's even older now.
Let's call the LA Times. They got it wrong.
Yeah.
But anyway, they got here's some others that you're not going to see mentioned often. Is Ennio Antonelli. He's from Italy.
Mm-hmm. Won't be in
Italian. Bergoglio, Argentina. Hoyas from Colombia. Dharmit Majida, Indonesia.
I haven't heard that one.
They're packing this
right.
Then Ivan Dias from India. And this is probably going to be Marika, Bob's wife's favorite. Lubomir Husar from the Ukraine.
No.
And don't say the Ukraine. It's got to be just Ukraine.
Ukraine.
Walter Kaspar, German. Can you imagine a German pope?
Oh, jeez.
They have tendencies to dictatorship.
You know,
already.
In all seriousness, I remember reading about
Hitler as pope.
Well, I got one better than that, actually. You know, I remember reading this about maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Maybe the guy is passed on. But there was speculation 5 or 6 years ago when the popes first started, I think it was revealed he had Parkinson's disease, whenever that was. I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago. And I was reading about speculation of who the papal candidates were at that time. And actually there was a pope, a cardinal from France who was born Jewish. So they could say the pope was a Jew. But I don't see his name on there. I don't know why. Maybe he's dropped out of the
pope
running.
Pope in the Vatican?
Jew in the Vatican. Yeah. He was born Jewish, converted to Catholicism when he was 16 or 17, went in the seminary, and moved up the ranks.
He knew where the power was.
Yeah, exactly. But my guess is going to be somebody, and we're going to get into this briefly, is somebody who supports what organization, Tom?
Opus Dei.
Opus Dei. And why don't you tell our listeners what Opus Dei is, if they have never heard of it, who some of the members are, and a little bit of their history, if you could. Could you do that?
I think so.
Go
Opus
right ahead.
Dei means?
Latin.
God's work. Okay, or work of God.
And just to give you an idea, before Tom starts, who some prominent members of Opus Dei are, Supreme Court Justice Scalia and actor Mel Gibson are Opus Dei members. So,
well,
with that in mind,
yeah, I think they're adherents. I think to be an actual member, you have to be but you can follow or support
adherents
and stuff like that. But anyway, the this group is an ultra conservative, right wing,
reactionary.
Are there any other more serious terms we can use?
No. You want to say they're into Inquisition, but we don't want to go that far.
Well, actually, the main guy, Ratzinger, they recreated revivified the group that conducted the Inquisition and made it permanent, put it under the Pope, and put Ratzinger in charge.
Hmm.
So that's why they call him the Enforcer.
Is that right? Oh, right.
Anyway, I have an article here from Vicente Navarro, professor from Johns Hopkins University, who has written a very interesting article about Opus Dei and John Paul II, a profoundly right-wing pope. And he's countering some of the kudos that the pope has been getting and the easy play he's been getting, and at least
right.
on television and less so on printed media. I want to point out that when they first said he died, everybody rushed to say what a great guy he was. A couple of days later, they're saying, well, yeah, but there's this other side to the guy.
Right.
Anyway, so this I'm just going to read a few selections from this. Writing from Baltimore. The predominant perception of John Paul II, as extensively reproduced in most of the Western media, is that he was very conservative. Traditional is the term widely used in religious subjects, but progressive in social matters, as evidenced by his defense of the poor and his concern for human and social rights. His key ideological role in the demise of the Soviet Union is put forward as further proof of his commitment to liberty and democracy. John Paul's support for the Polish trade union, Solidarity, we call it, his numerous speeches in support of the poor and of those left behind by capitalism or globalization, and his frequent calls for human solidarity, not to mention his opposition to the invasion of Iraq by U.S. forces, all are presented as examples of his progressiveness in the social arena. Well, that's one side of the coin.
That's one side.
In this perception of Pope John Paul II, some critical elements are forgotten. Let's detail them. He was groomed for the papacy long before he was elected pope by the ultra-right-wing sect Opus Dei. This secret organization was founded by Monsignor Escriva, a Spanish priest who was formerly a private confessor to General Franco.
Oh, what a nice guy he was, huh?
Organizing spiritual meetings for the Spanish fascist leadership. Opus Dei chose John Paul as the candidate for Pope very early in his career, when he was bishop at Krakow. His conservatism and anti-communism were very attractive to this sect. John Paul traveled extensively at the time on trips organized and funded by Opus Dei. Developed a very close working relationship with the sect. Opus Dei was the organization that developed the strategy to make him pope, assisted by the Bishop of Munich, Joseph Ratzinger.
That's where Ratzinger comes. His name's popping up quite a bit.
The U.S. Cardinals close to Opus Dei, Joseph Kroll and Patrick Cody, and a cardinal then close to Opus Dei, Cardinal Franz Koenig from Vienna, who later distanced himself from the Opus Dei and from the Pope. The center of operations for this campaign is, I love this, Villa Tver, the Opus Dei headquarters in Rome. They got their own building, you know. Anyway, so it goes on to detail some things.
Like a BFW hall, I suppose, huh?
Immediately after his election as Pope, John Paul designated Opus Dei as a special order, directly accountable to him.
Yep, they reported directly to him, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay.
When they do John Paul's life, I guess they can't use Marlon Brando anymore. Well, actually, he could resurrect them.
That's right. We'll make him an offer they can't refuse.
Directly accountable to him, not to the bishops.
We'll take over. We're going to take a very quick musical break right now. We'll be right back. You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street on KRBS 107.1 FM in Oroville, California, and this is Left Turn on Bird Street. Be right back.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, that thrills and delights me. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you. It isn't your sweet conversation that brings this sensation. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you. When you're in my arms and I feel you so close to me, all my wildest dreams come true. I need no soft lights to enchant me, but if you're you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street. My name is Dan Gelworthy, and I'm here with my colleague Tom Nadel. Thanks for staying with us through the musical break. Tom had a very important call that came in on his cell phone, so we had to take it. So
it was from a lawyer.
Was the lawyer.
And I was found not guilty.
All right. Woohoo! Tom, I'm glad to hear that. But this show is so important that you came to this show instead of going to the I love it.
Yeah, well, when it comes to choice between the Pope or the Pokey. Actually, I'm just joking. I'm not really going to jail.
This time. This time, okay.
Anyway, to pick up where I left off, immediately after his election as Pope, John Paul designated Opus Dei as a special order directly accountable to him, not to the bishops. He surrounded himself with the members of the order, most visible being Navarro Valls, an Opus Dei journalist who had worked for ABC, an ultra-conservative Spanish paper that had been supportive of the Franco regime. This explains why he's getting good press. Navarro Valls is well known for selecting journalists to cover the Pope's international visits who would report on them favorably. He constantly vetoed critical voices, such as that of Domenico Del Rio of the Italian paper La Repubblica. Anyway, so this is just some highlights. The Pope later named another Opus Dei member, Angelo Sodana, as Secretary of State of the Vatican. Opus Dei and its Pope were profoundly hostile to liberal liberation theology. John Paul condemned it at the second Latin American conference, presided over by Opus Dei member Monsignor Alfonso Lopez Trujillo. It goes on and on. His connections to this are really tight. John Paul was profoundly political, always on the side of the powerful in Latin America and Spain. In Spain, John Paul was political to an extreme. He was openly supportive of the post-Francoist party, the Popular Party, whose founder is Fraga Iribarne, ex-minister of the Interior. I think that's the guy who runs the CIA in that country, of the Franco-fascist regime. And, let's see, rather than pushing a social agenda worldwide, Pope John Paul became a major obstacle to such an agenda by making conservative issues, anti-abortion, anti-contraception, anti-homosexual, and others, rather than social ones, the center of his political arena and agenda. That's about it. So when we get Bob...
We're going to talk about this more at the 9 o'clock hour.
I want to say that Bob told me when I was doing the preview call.
Yes.
He says, I know I'm going to come off sounding like an apologist for Opus Dei, which I'm not.
Right. Tom, you're a popular man this morning. What, did you hit the button by accident?
I think that's to remind me that I got a call that I didn't answer. And turn this little sucker off.
Well, if you want we'll talk more about this, like I said, just a minute ago when Dr. Robert Ulanowitz joins us at the 9 o'clock hour. But if I were to handicap it, this is what I would do. I would take somebody who's a member of Opus Dei and somebody from the Third World. But I'll tell you the reasons. You have to stick with us till the 9 o'clock hour why I think that is going to happen.
But I want to say, we talked about this earlier,
mm-hmm.
Third World. Now the Third World cardinals outnumber the European cardinals.
Right, right.
And I think that John Paul II and the Opus Dei group mm-hmm. were playing the Southern strategy Richard Nixon. Packing.
Right. That's true. That's true. They're true. Well, I guess you could say we have a very theological-based agenda this morning, because the next thing we want to talk about is a story that Tom and I both read on counterpunch.org, and the name of the story is A People's Temple on a National Scale, George Bush's True Religion. It was written by Ron Jacobs. And do you have a copy of the story? Because I have a copy right here, Tom. Well, let me hand it to you. But and this appeared, I think, in the last 3 or 4 days in Counterpunch. And let's see, I tore it here, Tom. Here's the second page for you. There you go. And the printing, that was about the time my printer started giving out last night.
When I go blah, 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 you'll know that I got to the...
But basically, the crux of this story, and it's something that we want to discuss a little bit here this morning, is he makes a comparison between the people's, was it Reverend Jim Jones from San Francisco when he went to Guyana and he gave the Kool-Aid and everybody died? Was it the People's Temple that he called it in San Francisco? Is that the name of the... Yeah, it was, the People's Temple. And if you'll recall, I think it was 1978, and they were in French...
John Paul II, elected Pope.
That, you know, it was right around the same time. You're right, because John Paul was elected in October. I think this happened around... I want to say it was around Thanksgiving. It says October in the story, but my memory serves me it was about a week or two before Thanksgiving in 1978.
I was sitting at a bar at the time when the call came in, so...
Right. But, you know, if it just to refresh your memory, Reverend Jim Jones led a group of people, several hundred, from San Francisco to French Guiana in South America. They established a settlement, I guess you could call it, using the term loosely, I guess. And basically everybody committed suicide on his orders. And the author makes the comparison that this is not unlike what the situation we find ourselves in. Yes, with George Bush.
Using religion to control people and advance himself. 900 people died.
Right.
Mostly by drinking Kool-Aid laced with cyanide. Those who wouldn't drink it, they were
shot.
Killed.
Yeah, right, they were shot.
They also shot Leo Ryan.
Right, congressman from San Francisco.
Leo Ryan, from a congressman from San Francisco, and some aides, including Jackie Speier, who's now in the state assembly.
All right.
Or state senate, I guess she is now.
Right.
Anyway, went down there to take a look at it. Their gunman killed them as they were trying to leave on a plane, and this precipitated the suicide and all the hullabaloo.
Right.
And so Ron Jacobs, the author here, he's from Burlington, Vermont, so you know he's a liberal.
Yes.
Is thinking about a comparison between the two. He says, well, here we are 26 years later, and the whole damn country of the United States is on a similar trajectory as that small church out of the Bay Area. With the man of God, George Bush, playing the role of Jim Jones, millions of his followers, our fervent supporters, are absolute true believers in the man and the philosophy he espouses. This does not mean that the leader himself believes in the particular philosophy that he utters, at least not with the same fervor, but he certainly counts on a substantial number of his followers to have that faith. Eric Hoffer, a sort of San Francisco philosopher, mm-hmm. worked in the docks, wrote in his study of the fanatical believer, the true believer, he says, the less justified a man is in claiming excellence for his own self, the more ready he is to claim all excellence for his nation, his religion, his race, or his holy cause. A man is likely to mind his own business when it is worth minding. When it is not, he... takes his mind off his own meaningless affairs by minding other people's business. I think that pretty well...
Yeah, that says it right there.
Well, that's Bush right there.
Right, you know.
And used by others to do this.
Well, the other part of that is interesting, and this is a discussion my wife Jenny and I have had for the last 4 or 5 years anyhow about George Bush's posturing, I guess you could say, with the religious right. Is she is, you know, my wife, I'll say she's more spiritually inclined than I am. And, you know, her point is, and I agree with her now, is that people who are spiritually inclined tend not to wear it on their sleeves. Bush wears it on the sleeves, and it's pandering is really what he's doing. I don't think this guy believes...
Signaling,
sending word and code, whatever you want to call it. I don't think he believes it. And, you know, I used to think, yeah, maybe he did and he was scary. I think the part that's maybe even scarier, well, I guess it's relative. He's successful at doing it. And there's so many people, and this goes back maybe to the conversation we were talking about at the beginning of the hour when I was in England. You know, just as a side note, when, you know, relatively speaking, you know, we were in several different parts of the country. But, you know, you didn't see all these, you know, you saw some churches there, but they were kind of nondescript older churches. You didn't see all these, like, neighborhood churches and... You know, they were kind of the mainstream Anglican churches you saw, you know, over in England as the structures. You didn't see the fish on the bumper, you know, the little fish symbol on the bumpers of people's cars.
And the church is my favorite. I saw this in Berkeley when I was a cab driver.
Right.
The upstairs church of Jesus Christ and God.
Right. Yeah, well, I like the downstairs one better, actually.
No, this is the basement sign one outside of a house on one of the side streets in Berkeley. The upstairs church of Jesus Christ and God.
But I think the author makes Ron Jacobs makes a really excellent point in this, is that I don't think Bush necessarily agrees with all of this, but he panders so much to this group, and that they want to believe what he's saying. They want to believe what he's saying so bad that they'll do anything to follow him, you know, act against. And this is the part we've discussed over and over again on this show, is people they want to believe in this so much that they'll vote for somebody like Bush, even if it's against their own economic self-interest.
Well, it says, he goes...
That's the diabolical part of it, really.
Jacobs goes on to make a couple of points. Says, this, as I was just reading, this is the mindset of those in our government and our populace who have no time to argue with those who disagree with them, even if those disagreements are minor, as minor as the differences George Bush and Democrats, who also like John Kerry, have over policy in foreign affairs. Poorly written here. To the true believer, there is only one way, and it doesn't matter if that way has a foundation in reason, only that it makes sense to the believer. And he goes on now to say, to continue the analogy to today's global people's temple, that is the Republican Party and George Bush,
right,
under the ministry of George Bush, it is probably safe to say that a similar fear is part of what is behind Bush's actions. And the actions of his most fervent followers. And so, we're going on here. I'm getting a hard time to read this, but Afghanistan, let's see, blah, blah, blah. Investigative groups did vis-a-vis Jonestown, just like the various governments and private investigative groups did vis-a-vis Jonestown and People's Temple. Perhaps someone should launch an investigation to determine how many members of Bush's temple in Iraq, Afghanistan, are there of their own volition, and how many have been taken there against their will.
Well, I don't know.
I think that's a kind of sly, it's a sort of sly reference to drafted people who...
Yeah, right.
They're not drafted anymore, but I mean, people in the military don't want to go, but go.
Right, right. Well, it's just interesting. I think it's an interesting analogy between the Jonestown.
I mugged it up here, but I think that if you start looking at George Bush and start thinking Jim Jones, you know, a lot of this will come clear.
Yeah.
And not only that, but you don't have to look at him. Just listen to the supporters. Listen to them. I actually happened to be in San Francisco this time and did interview people who were members who didn't go. And there's a similarity in mindset.
Right. I guess it's they're both using the Bible or religion to control people, and that's really what it boils down to.
There's a certain psychology at work. People need to be followers, some people.
Right.
And I think that's about 98% of the people in the United States.
Well, actually, that's true. You know, it's like the old saying, people are like sheep, you know, and it's no mistake that in biblical references, they talk about Jesus being the shepherd and leading
flock.
His flock.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, there is actually...
I had my car flopped.
Right. Well, you're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street. We broadcast from KRBS in Oroville, California at 107.1 FM. And we'd like to remind you to take a look at our blog, which is at www.ltobs.blogspot.com. Or you can Google us, excuse me, at... you can Google us, Left Turn on Bird Street, and we show up at the top of your queue. So we certainly would invite you to take a look at our blog and participate in several of the lively discussions on some of the stories we have posted. We had some real good ones last week. With Alberto, if you're out there listening, we enjoyed your feedback, and please come back and visit us again. Even though we don't believe a word of what you're saying, it was nonetheless interesting.
Every website needs a... jerk to make fun of.
That's right.
Actually, I think you are, Albert. You're just putting us on. Nobody
I have
thinks that
plausible
way.
Deniability. I was in Salem, Oregon at a karaoke bar. I swear to God.
I've heard of the internet. Have you?
No. Tom. How many times am I going to tell you? It's not the internet. It's the Internets.
Yeah, right.
In fact, that was one of the things that our host in England, they laughed about. They said, "Oh, I'm glad to hear that you have the internets over there in the United States." And what can you do? Say, the leader of the free world is from the United States, and he can't even pronounce the word right. So, Tom is signaling to me, we got to move on with our agenda here because we're coming up. We got 15 more minutes in this hour, but we want to talk about the economic tsunami that's about to come. And there's several different indicators about the state of the American economy and I guess for that matter, the world economy. But again, once again, we've had, we reference a story that we found on counterpunch.org. And Tom, why don't you, the name of the story is Coming Sooner Than You Think, The Economic Tsunami by Mike Whitney.
Yes, and it's off Counterpunch, and says, I'll just scoot along here rather than read the whole thing, but he premises it on this quote from the New York Times editorial from April 2, the day after April Fool's Day. If the world's central bankers accumulate fewer dollars, the result would be an unrelenting American need to borrow in the face of an ever weaker dollar. A recipe for higher interest rates and higher prices. The economic repercussions could unfold gradually, resulting in a long, slow decline in living standards. Or there could be a quick unraveling with the hallmarks of an uncontrolled fiscal crisis.
Depression. I think it's the latter.
Anyway, so Whitney opens by saying, it seems that there are a growing number of people who believe, as I do, that the economic tsunami planned by the Bush administration is probably only months away. That's like we're looking
months.
At June.
Yeah.
June is also the month that they're planning to invade Iran.
Iran, right.
In just 5 short years, the national debt has increased by nearly $3 trillion.
$3 trillion, T-R-I-I.
That's bigger than a billion.
Right. A trillion is 1,000 billion.
Oh, okay.
That's what a trillion is. It's 1,000 billion.
Okay.
$1 trillion. It's a lot of money.
$3 trillion, while the dollar has continued its predictable decline. The dollar has fallen a whopping 38% since Bush took office, due largely to the massive $450 billion per year tax cuts he gave to the rich. At the same time, numerous laws have been passed. Patriot Act, Intelligence Reform Bill, Homeland Security Bill, National ID, passport requirements, etc., etc., anticipating the need for a greater repression when the economy takes an inevitable nosedive. Regrettable? Leap. That nosedive looks to be coming sooner rather than later. And he goes on to say that the administration is currently putting as much pressure as possible on OPEC to ratchet up the flow of oil another 1 million barrels per day, well over capacity, to settle down nervous markets and buy time for the planned bombing of Iran in June. Like Fed Chief Alan Greenspan's artificially low interest rates, the manipulation of oil production is a way of concealing how dire the situation really is. Rising prices at the pump signal an upcoming recession. Depression? So the administration is pulling out all the stops to meet the short-term demand and maintain the illusion that things are still okay. Bush would rather avoid massive popular unrest while his battle plans for Iran are carried out. But, of course, things are not okay. And we go on to discuss it, and you can see he refers to this same Ponzi scheme. You know what Ponzi scheme
yeah.
is? Yeah. Paying Peter to Paul?
Right.
To pay Paul? Paying John.
Ponzi was an actual guy. Did you know that?
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah, that, and now, see, he's living in history. Yeah. You know, a life of crime is the way to succeed.
Excuse me.
The same Ponzi scheme has been carried out repeatedly by the IMF, World Bank, throughout the world, Argentina being the last dramatic illustration. Argentina's economic collapse occurred, I love this one, when its trade deficit was running at 4%. Right now, ours is at an unprecedented
6%. Yeah.
I'm not going to try to read this whole thing.
Well, you know what? Let me jump in here. You know, this whole conversation makes me, you know what one person it makes me think of? Seriously. You know who this, this whole deficit spending and the deficits, who does this remind you of? Go back in time, 1992. Now, listen, you people. This is H. Ross Perot here. A little lunatic. He was a lunatic. The guy was a lunatic, but he was right. The guy was right. He was right on the money
with this. Tell the truth, no election.
Right. Yeah, well, plus, George Bush is out to ruin my world-class daughter's wedding. But the little lunatic was right. You know, deficits do matter. Trade deficit, these huge deficits.
Look right here.
Yeah, right. With his little charts and stuff. The guy was right, though. I mean, he was right. You know, the guy's a paranoid little lunatic feeding at the federal trough. But he was right. You know, most our debt is held by who? The Japanese, the Chinese, the Saudis, Germany, the euro. And then the other half of the equation is not only have we mortgaged our future to all these other countries, but the other thing that's happening now is because our dollar's continually devaluing, and I can speak to that when I was in England, everything was, you know, like a beer was as twice as expensive there as it is here because the pound is twice the, you know, has twice the value of the dollar. Where about 10 years ago, I think it was about one and a quarter to two.
So if I flee to Belize, beer will be cheaper?
Gee, I don't know about the exchange rate with Belize. Do they go on the pound there? No, it'll be more expensive. Belize is probably on the pound. They probably peg theirs to the pound, I'm going to guess.
I don't know. But it's a poorer country with less valuable money.
Well, you know, that's what we're becoming now. We are becoming a country with less valuable money. And what happens, in the real danger in the world economics, is that the central banks in other countries, Japan, China, and obviously Europe, England, throughout the world, Korea, they start switching their currency from dollar-backed currency to the euro. The euro is very strong.
They're mixing euros with other currencies too, so it doesn't look like they're making a big jump like that right now.
Right, right, exactly. But you know, they're slowly moving their currencies from the dollar to the euro. So we have this huge trade deficit, and you know, this is economics 101. You cannot continue to run up these huge deficits and run up the debt, which are two different things, because deficit is an annual thing. The debt is the cumulative thing. You cannot continue to run both of these without and at the same time give tax breaks. And this is, you know, I guess this is no coincidence. This is getting off on a tangent, but this is why a lot of corporations and a lot of individuals are setting offshore accounts. They're transferring their wealth out of this country. They're gonna, and when the economic decline comes, who's gonna be left holding the bag? You know, 98% of the regular people that you know aren't in that 2 or 3% of the top income earners are going to be screwed, and it's going to happen. I mean, you start looking, and it's not going to take much. We have high gas prices, which is inflationary. Strange as it may sound, we have some stories here. You know, obviously it's hitting at the gasoline pump, but it's making groceries more expensive. Pizza delivery companies are adding surcharges.
I want to talk
now
about that.
Yeah.
First of all, this,
I mean, that's a real life case.
Well, I realize this got me thinking. They want to, you know what they charge those drivers, by the way, 95 cents a pizza?
God, how can they make any money?
A lot of pizzas. But they get this. Is that, wait a minute. So when they weren't doing this, those of us who went in to buy the pizza there,
mm-hmm. Take out.
Yeah, right. When we went in there, our price was artificially high,
right,
so we could subsidize those who were too lazy to get off their butts and come down and pick it up.
Right, right. Right.
So what I'm thinking is, now that they're adding this surcharge, what they should do is increase the surcharge for those who are too lazy to get down and get it themselves, and reduce the price for those of us who are not too lazy.
Well, you would think that would make maybe sense from our point of view, but from their point of view, they're probably getting a surcharge from their suppliers who are delivering the cheese to the pizza place, because, you know, all the cheese is controlled by the, how shall we say it? Well, the cheese business, seriously, in Detroit, you know who controls the mozzarella cheese business? The mafia does. I swear to God. They control it.
And you know this by?
Well, I mean, I can't say, you know, otherwise I'd have to.
Popular local rumor.
Right. But I'm serious.
Speaking of surcharges, did you meet him in England?
Surcharges. I can't say.
Surcharge.
No, because you know what? Their gas is the equivalent of $6 a gallon, and has been that way for years and years and years and years. I mean,
no,
you know,
I thought maybe he was nobility.
Well,
surcharge.
Surcharge. Tom, you're ever the comedian here. You know, just as a side note.
You can't be intelligent, be funny.
Yeah, well, just as a side note, and this goes into the gasoline issue and the whole economic tsunami. You know, one thing I was really relieved not to see when I was in England, guess.
Americans?
Well, well, yeah, I guess I could say that, you know. No, but there. Let me be more specific. What did I not see on the highways and byways and little country roads in England? What did I not see?
A lot of cars.
Well, you know, you didn't see a lot of cars, but specifically, no SUVs.
None?
One.
What about billboards?
No, very few billboards.
A civilized country, no SUVs, no billboards.
I mean, you know, they're living in the dark ages, obviously. But seriously, there were no SUVs that I saw, you know, in Northwest England or in London. Excuse me. But you know, this goes back to, you know, the economic tsunami. People, you know, and we don't have Jenny and I don't have a we have a minivan. Just give you an example. Jenny nearly died last week. She had to go fill up the tank and the we have a 1991 Ford Aerostar minivan, and we're going to probably get rid of that because we don't have all the kids at home anymore.
Cost it to a museum?
Yeah, right. It's a not, and our other car is an 84 Honda, giving an indication of where we're coming from. And Jenny's driving the Honda all the time now. She said it cost her $50 to fill up the...
You're joking.
$50. She said she, you know, started pumping and went in and got something and came back, and she thought somebody had came and, you know, stole the pump while she was in there and put some gas in there. But it was, you know, we have about a 17 or 18 gallon tank, and it filled it up, and it was about 17 or 18 gallons.
Well, you know,
running on fumes when we got there.
You know, I only put in a half a tank of gas at a time. I'm very conservative. But when gas prices started to go up, I would arrive at the gas station, and I'd go to the pump, and I'd see what the previous guy put on.
Right.
And I started seeing things like 35, 45. I'm thinking, boy, I didn't know that they could get these big diesel trucks in here.
No,
that's just regular cars. That's a Cadillac.
That's 10 gallons, Tom. Seriously.
Macy's Cadillac just cracked the $30.
Is that right? She must have a small tank then. Seriously.
Yeah, she's that Katerra.
Yeah, right.
And that's the sort of like smaller version that lasted about 2 years, I think.
Right. Well,
we're making enough money on that one.
You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street on KRBS 107.1 FM, and we'd like to continue this discussion about the coming economic tsunami, and we probably will next week, but just suffice it to say, things are going to go down the drink, we think, pretty fast. So we're
gonna, don't blame us.
Don't
we
blame us.
You.
We're warning you. We are warning you. So I want to also take this opportunity to remind our listeners about KRBS's forthcoming Day of the Dead. It's on Saturday, April 16th.
Hey, I got a big dispute here.
Yes.
You're a Catholic. You went to Catholic schools.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
The Day of the Dead is November 1st.
Right. That's right. All Saints Day.
Okay. Well, what... why are we doing all the Day of the Dead here on April 15th? Is it the tax thing?
No, because April 14th is the third anniversary of KRBS. And the Day of the Dead is like on a Saturday, so it's like Day of the, you know, Grateful Dead kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Now I understand.
Got it now, Tom? Okay. It's live music, and it's going to, well, just get more information, call here at the station at 534-1200. But that will be this coming Saturday, day after tax day, from 7 a.m. to 12 a.m. Does that mean 12 a.m. like midnight, I guess? Or is that?
I think so.
I guess 12 a.m. It could be a hell of a party.
That's why people say midnight and noon.
Right, right.
To avoid that confusion.
Well, we got a call in.
Again.
Well, we got another call. Anyhow, we'll be taking a break, and when we come back, we'll have Dr. Robert Ulanowicz. So stay with us. You're listening to KRBS 107.1, Left Turn on Bird Street.
Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss, another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss. The days are bright and filled with pain. Enclose me in your gentle